So it's an intimidating thing to come to Casper, Wyoming, to give a talk about how do you cultivate a culture that, you know, inspires people to be involved in the community when I look around the crowd here and most of you are people who cultivated my culture and led me to be involved in the community. All right. But it's good to be back to Casper to be able to share a little smidget of what we have going on at the college. Our seniors spend an entire semester studying American culture and reflecting on what it means to be involved in the American culture. So we're going to try to condense that, at least for my talk, into less than an hour, and then we'll have two more, Dr. Roberts, our president, and Dr. Arbery, our professor of political philosophy, who will be coming later this summer. And I'm really just the band opener. The really good part of the show comes later. So I'm just here to get the name out. So if you like what you see here, it only gets better. If you don't, it gets better. So come again. All right. So what I want to focus on is the question of liberty, but in a way that's probably different than the way we hear it characterized often. In terms of political rhetoric, since about 2009, there's been a huge increase in the amount that we use the word liberty in terms of political discussions. The Tea Party's been hugely involved in that. The libertarian movement has gotten its bigger name for itself out here as it keeps pushing forward the idea of liberty, the idea of freedom. But there's not a lot of time spent thinking about what exactly we mean when we say liberty. It's one of those good things. You say, who's in favor of liberty? It's like being in favor of life or chocolate or various other unquestionable goods. No one's going to run on a campaign of, I hate liberty. But we don't spend a lot of time thinking about what that means. Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence offers the world not only a beautifully crafted sentence, but he also makes a claim about the relationship between government and liberty. He says, among other things, government is instituted to ensure the blessings of liberty. But as is clear from the very circumstances of Jefferson's writing, a government can fail to achieve that goal. Now, it's become fairly commonplace for us to assume that if you have the right set of governing principles, you have freedom, you have liberty. We have the idea of democracy equals freedom, such that when George W. Bush says, we want to make the world a place where freedom reigns, he follows that up with saying, a world where democracy reigns. There's an identification between if you have democracy, you have freedom. Now, Woodrow Wilson articulated the idea in a speech where he was distinguishing between the administrative work of government and the political work. And he says, the Constitution is the vital spring of liberty or servitude. Liberty cannot live apart from a constitutional principle. And no administration, however perfect and liberal its methods, can give men more than a poor counterfeit of liberty if it rests upon illiberal principles of government. So for Wilson, we have a top-down view of liberty. You have the right governing principles, you have the right laws, and voila, we're free. Whatever else happens, happens. We just have to have the right stuff at the beginning. On the other side of things, we can have the bottom-up view of liberty, or freedom from the ground up, which would be a clever title for a talk, just to let you know. All right. One of the biggest proponents of this view is not someone who we might initially identify as a political philosopher. But nevertheless, he's a man who formulated some really basic principles of how to understand freedom in society, the very principles that end up leading to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. This man I'm talking about is John Paul II. And one of John Paul II's constant themes was that there was a freedom that existed first and foremost as the right of an individual person in virtue of his inalienable dignity. This freedom was then first expressed by this individual's relationships to various small communities, such as the family, economic communities, social communities, political and cultural groups, all of them stemming from that original human nature and having their own proper autonomy or their rightful sovereignty. It is the human person and his network of societal relationships who acts, as John Paul II notes, within a culture and interacts with that culture. And it is in this cultural sphere of action that we have an influence that influences the state and something that is meant to be served by the state. This is what underlies what runs through Catholic social doctrine as the principle of subsidiarity. The state is a community of a higher order, and it arises from and is ordered to helping lower level communities, not by interfering with their functions, but by supporting them, coordinating activities with them, and all looking toward the common good that they're all serving together. Thus, the culture created by these smaller communities is prior to the state. And it is in cooperation with this culture that the state maintains the freedom of the individuals and the society at large, and vice versa. It is the human person acting as a member of a free society that is then going to maintain and preserve the nature of the state. So when we talk about freedom from this perspective, it's not enough to have the right set of laws at the beginning that are made once, and as long as we don't change them, we're good, we're free. Instead, we're talking about a challenge that each one of us faces as we interact with our families, as we interact with our neighborhoods and other small groups. This is the idea of freedom coming first from something we do and being recognized and fully realized in the state. Now, John Paul II acknowledges there may be times and exceptional circumstances when the state may need to supplement certain of these societal groups, certain business systems, for what he notes are urgent reasons touching on the common good. But, he says, such supplementary interventions must be as brief as possible so as to avoid removing permanently from society and business systems the functions which are properly theirs, and so as to avoid enlarging excessively the sphere of state intervention to the detriment of the original civil freedom. So for John Paul II, the increase of state activity in the cultural sphere, whether that be in the economic, local, or familial sphere, no matter how well-intentioned, risks undermining the culture that preserves the freedom of the nation. Now, this is a neat idea, but it's not merely a religious idea thought up by some Eastern European. I think it's an idea that we have at the very basis of American society, at the very moment of the country's founding, if you will. In fact, moments after Ben Franklin has walked out of the Constitutional Convention, a woman asks him, "Doctor, what kind of government did you give us?" And his answer was, "A republic, if you can keep it." Now, there's two parts to Franklin's answer. First, he identifies the government that's given as a republic. Now, by a republic, we don't mean necessarily a democracy, a monarchy, an aristocracy, first and foremost. The method of government is not the first thing we intend when we say republic. According to a contemporary of Ben Franklin, Thomas Paine, what is called a republic is not any particular form of government. Rather, republican government is no other than government established and conducted for the interest of the public, both individually and collectively. So this government, with the idea of a republic, we have the idea of a people that precedes that government, a people who have a distinct identity before the government is formed, and that the government is supposed to facilitate their access to some good that is also distinct from the government. That's what we're going for. The second part of Franklin's answer is even more important, the "if you can keep it" part. Again, he's recognizing that we have the right laws, but there's a certain requirement on the part of the people to maintain the ordering of the government to the common good. Now, that idea isn't exclusive to Franklin. I think that idea is common to a lot of founding fathers. James Madison, the man who's called the father of the Constitution, expresses that idea well in his 55th Federalist paper. He's dealing with the question of how many people should be in the House of Representatives. And the claim is, if the House of Representatives is too small, we're going to fall into a tyranny. that people are going to get corrupt by their desire for money, their desire for their desire for power, and then the whole thing's going to fall apart. And so Madison writes this response. He says, as there is a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust, so there are other qualities in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence. Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form. Were the pictures that have been drawn by political jealousy of some among us faithful actual likenesses of the human character, the inference would be that there is not sufficient virtue among men for self-government. Nothing less than the chains of despotism can restrain us from destroying and devouring one another. So again, we have Madison resolving to, well, yeah, we have a great Constitution, and all your objections to the Constitution would be answered if we can assume a certain character to the people that are the subjects of that law. So it is this character of the people that not only Madison, but many a founder appeals to as the hope for the republican nature of our government. But for all that such a character was frequently referenced by the founders, the bulk of their work was devoted to the more intense questions of balance of powers, governmental structures, etc. The brilliant political science of the authors of the Federalist Papers rarely gives us a detailed analysis of the principles and marks of the societal character that they presume will exist for this government to function. In part, this is because it's tough to describe the environment where you live. Fish, even assuming they were intelligent, would have a very difficult time describing the sensation of water. Right? Whereas for us, who suddenly plunge ourselves into water, we'd be able to instantly say, wow, this feels different. When you're surrounded by an environment, it's harder to be aware of the things that characterize it. So it is that it takes us over 50 years for some outside observer to be able to come to the United States and say, ah, this is the culture, these are the customs, this is the character that Madison and Jefferson and Franklin were talking about. This is just what they assumed. But it took someone, like us jumping into the water, it took someone from France making the long voyage over and spending some time to look around. And this man is one of my single favorite thinkers ever, Alexis de Tocqueville. He's a 19th century French aristocrat who visited America and then wrote perhaps the best book ever written on either democracy or America. And he titles it Democracy in America. What do you know, all right? De Tocqueville writes this book as a self-professed lover of liberty and offers us a study in what are the virtues necessary to provide for a free society. Obviously, a book written in the 1830s cannot speak to all aspects of our modern political experience, right? But I maintain that Tocqueville does offer us insights into the principles that are necessary to foster a culture that will preserve liberty. He names with precision the virtues and traits that Madison presupposed, and his insight is attested in his incredible ability to predict the course of society based on his understandings of the principle and character of the Republic. So let me give you a few of his predictions to make you trust the man a little bit more. Right? First quote. Now remember, he wrote this in the 1830s. Okay. So, first quote. There are two peoples on earth today who, starting from different points, seem to advance toward the same goal. And these are the Russians and the Americans. The Americans allow the force and reason of individuals to act without directing them. Russia concentrates all the power of society in one man. The Americans have freedom for their principal means of action, the Russians, servitude. Their point of departure is different, their ways are diverse. Nonetheless, each of them seems called by a secret design of Providence to hold the destinies of half the world in their hands one day. Okay. So after predicting the Cold War, our Nostradamus of democracy predicted a little bit more. Next quote. If America ever experiences great revolutions, they'll be brought about by the presence of blacks on the soil of the United States. Now, after the Civil War and the Civil Rights Revolution, we think, wow, two for two. What about the debate about tax loopholes? De Tocqueville is on it. In other words, the democratic government is the only one in which those who vote for taxes can escape the obligation to pay it. And this will become a matter of contention quickly. And lastly, the current size and scope of government. Quote, thus a democratic government increases its power simply by the fact of its permanence. Time is on its side. Every incident befriends it. And it may be asserted that the older a democratic community is, the more centralized will its government become. Now, if you sit in on class at Wyoming Catholic College, you'll also hear and predict talk radio, the College Board and the SAT exam, and various other things. But we'll just leave that for the moment, all right? De Tocqueville seems to have been on to something, at least that he gets things right so often. As wide-ranging as his work is, for tonight we're going to focus on Tocqueville's account of the kind of culture that needs to exist in a democracy, in order to ensure that we have this freedom on the ground up model. Okay? So first off, Tocqueville is convinced that democracy is not the same thing as freedom. They may go together, they may not. Our modern experience confirms this. The Nazis were elected by a democratic process. The current crisis in Iraq that has all the conservatives hoping to show up Obama and all the liberals hoping we don't have another foreign policy debacle is again another way of proving just having a democratic constitution does not guarantee the existence of a free society. So de Tocqueville suggests something that Abraham Lincoln will also agree with. We need to consider democracy first and foremost as simply a government that comes from the people and is overseen in some way by the people. But more important than just the fact that we vote, de Tocqueville said there's another characterization of a democracy. And that is an incredible passion for equality. Tocqueville notes that amongst democratic peoples, there is nothing they love more than equality. And they are even willing to give up freedom for the chance of ensuring things stay equal. So the challenge for democracy, according to Tocqueville, is to navigate this incredible desire for equality in a way that preserves freedom. It says we can't change it. We can't tell people, oh no, don't love equality so much. That's not going to happen. We have no control of this incredible passion for equality. And politicians may, in fact, stoke the fires of this. Hence the reason why the 99% and the 1% has now become a quick phrase on all of our lips. We just are concerned about the fact that some people are so much better off than others. It drives us crazy. We're not going to change that. But what we are going to try to deal with is the fact that amidst our love of equality, what can we do to navigate that and still preserve freedom? Prevent us from tyrannizing over someone who I'm mad at because he's better off than I am. How do I prevent that from devolving and somehow keep us living together in freedom? Now, Dr. Arbery will spend a lot of time talking about the social political structure for doing that. I want to talk about the cultural structure. So first off, as we're talking about weighing equality versus freedom, we need a definition for freedom. Now, Tocqueville offers us a definition that he takes from John Winthrop, kind of. Since he's writing in French, he's able to sort of change the way John Winthrop says it and makes it more in keeping with what he wants him to say. So if John Winthrop had been thinking as clearly as Tocqueville, he would have said this, Tocqueville tells us. And it's pretty close. And Tocqueville assures us that this definition is the most beautiful definition of freedom ever proposed, better than anything a political scientist in Enlightenment Europe has been able to come up with. Here's the definition. Let us not deceive ourselves about what we understand by our independence. There is, in fact, a sort of corrupt liberty whose usage is common to animal and man, and which consists in doing all that one pleases. This liberty is the enemy of all authority. It suffers impatiently all rules. With it, we become inferior to ourselves. This liberty is the enemy of truth and peace, and God believed it necessary to rise against it. But there is a civil and moral liberty that finds its force in union, and which it is the mission of power to protect. This is the liberty to do without fear all that is just and good. This holy liberty we ought to defend through all the hazards and expose for it, if necessary, our very lives. So this is the definition of liberty that de Tocqueville wants to take up. He speaks of a moral and civil liberty, a liberty that's understood based on the dignity of the individual, but in a way that is realized in union with his fellow men, the moral order, and God himself. It is not merely a freedom from any civil or even metaphysical authority. It is a freedom for the just and good that can, in fact, be aided by political power. We're a long way from Justice Kennedy's definition of freedom, which is the right to determine for oneself the meaning of life, the meaning of morality, and one's own definition of the meaning of existence. That's not the definition of freedom we're dealing with here. And in fact, de Tocqueville's definition of freedom is distinct from the popular ideas of freedom that are happening in Enlightenment Europe at this time. During the Enlightenment, we had a lot of great thinkers, really good men, trying to articulate an account of freedom, an account of the structure of the state, that would allow them to justify rebelling against bad kings, and then structure a government in such a way that would preserve civil liberty for all the individuals in it. Now, to do that, these men proposed a theory where freedom was characterized in opposition to not only authority, but society itself. So they proposed an idea of what they call the state of nature. In this, we have our individual. Let him be a caveman, let him be a strong, handsome, rugged individual, whoever we want him to be, we have our individual, who exists completely separate from all other society. This man is in his natural state, according to John Locke, Rousseau, and various others. And this man is absolutely free. He can do whatever he wants. He wants to pick fruit, he can pick fruit. He wants to ride a horse, he can ride a horse. He wants to shoot you, he can shoot you. All right? He is in absolute freedom. But this man decides that he would like to have a nicer life. Not just having to depend on his own hunting skills. He'd like to have a lazy boy. He'd like to have a house, a family, a couple of cars, various other things that are, you know, essential for the good life. And so this man enters into a community based on some contract, some agreement. And as he enters into this agreement, he gives up some of his absolute freedom. But what he doesn't give up, those things that he does that society can't tell him not to do, those remain what are his freedoms. So he can no longer kill his neighbor when he gets mad at his neighbor. He can no longer take his neighbor's property when he wants his neighbor's property. But he can still say whatever he wants. He can still keep his own property. He can do these things. And so it's what he hasn't given up to society that we define as freedom. Now, Tocqueville rejects this understanding of freedom for two reasons. In the first place, he rejects the idea of the state of nature because it's just a myth. There is no evidence that we have ever had some individual not existing in some kind of communal relationship at any point. It may be the case that someone got lost. We have a Robinson Crusoe or something, right? But the idea that the origin of society is we have a bunch of scattered individuals who decide, hey, let's get together and pool our collective liberties for the sake of making more money. We don't have that. There's no historical record of that. And de Tocqueville is excited about studying America because, unlike the rest of civilization, we actually know what happened to them at the beginning. Rome, it shrouded in the mist of time. There's some story about two twins nursing on a wolf when they start a city, right? The Native Americans talk about coming out of a coyote or something like that, and the Norse have their own legend. No, but with Americans, we actually know what happened. There were these people that were pilgrims. They came. They had a set law. They had a set principle. They had set goals for their society. And so Providence, as Tocqueville says, has given us a torch to understand the origin of society. And so making up some myth about the state of nature as our way to explain where freedom comes from seems to be giving away this gift we have of, oh no, freedom came from this concrete situation. This is where freedom came from in America. But the second and more important reason Tocqueville doesn't like this idea of freedom is because this idea of freedom that John Locke and various others proposes was intended as a way to keep us free, right? To protect us from the tyranny of the government. But instead, it leaves each individual isolated and naked before the power of the state. The individual becomes an object to be administrated, but not an individual with inherent dignity and right to life. The whole structure of my social contract is I won't take your liberty away from you because I don't want you to take my liberty away from me. It's a mutually confirmed destruction kind of theory, right? We have a mutual deterrence going on. But when the state has a lot more guns and a lot more money and a lot more power, I'm not really in a position to say, oh, omnipotent state, if you don't infringe on my rights, I won't infringe on your rights. I don't have that option anymore. And so while the individuals are left somewhat powerless, the state grows in authority, and my idea of the only thing between the state and me is some agreement of I won't hurt you if you don't hurt me, I have an individual who's now at risk for tyranny. As de Tocqueville notes, despotism sees the most certain guarantee of its own duration in the isolation of men. And it puts all its care into isolating them. There is no vice of the human heart that agrees with a despot as much as selfishness. He readily pardons the governed if they don't love him, provided they don't love each other. He calls those who aspire to unite their efforts to create common prosperity turbulent. And he names those who confine themselves narrowly to their own interests good citizens. Despotism makes a public virtue of indifference. Now, I'm kind of preaching to the choir here insofar as it's a summer evening and you're all gathered in the basement of some library to hear a talk about civic virtue. And I'm going to tell you, we need to be concerned, we need to be involved, we need to care, and you clearly care. But maybe you can tell your friends. All right, so. Now, the Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller, who lived under Nazi Germany, he expresses a similar idea that Tocqueville does. But as opposed to predicting it, like Tocqueville is, he's saying it from his lived experience. He writes a poem that is currently enshrined at the Holocaust Museum. It's been said in various forms. I'll read you the form that's in the Holocaust Museum. It says, first they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And at last they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. So our state of nature myth, our social contract theory idea, has just me, the individual, and the state. I've removed the intermediary of my political association. I've removed the intermediary of my economic associations. I've removed the intermediary of my religious groups. It's just me against the state. And in that situation, there's no one left to speak for me. So for de Tocqueville's account of liberty, the individual needs to be connected to a natural, civil, and moral network in a way that is prior to his connection to the state. Now, by prior here, I don't mean chronologically. I don't mean that we first have a family, and then there's a couple of families, and they form a trade union, or a church, and then they form a trade union, and then they form a political party, and eventually we make a state. We don't have this chronological ordering. So when I say that these networks are first, I mean first in more the way I would say first at the science fair. All right, the little boy who wins first prize at the science fair doesn't win first because he was the first one through the door. He wins first because he did the best work. He did the stuff that was most important. Or if I were going to give reasons to my daughter about why she should clean her room, I would say, first, because I told you so. Now, that happens to be the first thing I said, but what's really first is that's the foundational reason she should clean her room, right? So this is the kind of first that de Tocqueville's talking about. These social networks come first before the state because they're more important. And they're the foundation for what the state is going to do. So culture, or the social state is the word that Tocqueville likes to use, is the atmosphere and the medium through which the individual exercises his freedom. It is this atmosphere through which the individual reaches out in the pursuit of the truth, the justice, and the goodness that John Winthrop said were the objects of freedom in that definition that Tocqueville quoted. This atmosphere includes the history, the language, the habits of mind and heart through which the society attempts to relate itself to these transcendent ideals and answer the questions about the meaning of personal existence. And this atmosphere is the fundamental prior condition for civil society. The state is not erected over a bunch of cavemen. The state is erected over a bunch of thinking, willing, loving people who have relationships, who want to pursue the important things in life. So the individual does not just participate in culture in some kind of abstract way, right? We don't have a bunch of beyond the cavemen, we have a bunch of individual philosophers who have all thought, I think the best way for me to pursue truth, justice, and goodness is by erecting a society and forming the Constitution. First and foremost, we figure out what it means to pursue these things in our concrete relationships. We fall in love, we get married, we have kids, we have parents, we have an extended family, we have chess clubs, checker clubs, baseball clubs, various other things. Right? At fundamental point, Tocqueville would be saying something like this, put in a very concrete way. My baseball club doesn't exist so the state can tax my sports team. My baseball club exists because we love baseball, we've decided to pursue baseball, and we're willing to enter into a political society to help preserve our love of baseball. Right? We'd say the same thing about all these other social networks that are in some sense prior to the state. Right? I don't have a family to increase the citizens of the state. I have a family because I love having a family. Right? And it's having a family that I realize it would be good for my family to be in relation to other families and to moderate that relationship by some kind of a law. So, what are these intermediate institutions? I've given a couple of examples. My baseball club, my family. The first, of course, is my family. In terms of order of prior, the family is a little bit more important than the baseball club. It's tough for me to remember at times, but it's true. All right. After that, Tocqueville says, you first learn the habits of liberty around the hearth or around the kitchen table. Then you learn it at church. You learn it in your religious groups. You learn it in your community where you're getting together and talking about the most important things about why you do what you do. And then after that, at last, the baseball club comes, along with all the other various other organizations that have goals, pursuits, loves that we meet together to pursue and enshrine and give a texture and a subjectivity to society that's bigger than just any given individual. All right? And on top of all that, de Tocqueville notes, we finally come to what he calls the township. The township is around 2,000 to 3,000 people. And Tocqueville says the township is the sole association that is so much in nature that everywhere men are gathered, a township forms by itself. Township society therefore exists among all people, whatever their usages and their laws may be. It is man who makes kingdoms and creates republics. but it is the township that appears to issue directly from the hands of God. That this slightly larger than neighborhood structure where we get together and we decide, this is what it means to live in this place with these values based on our families, our economic groups, our social groups, all of the rest. And we're trying to decide for ourselves, how do we keep being this? So for de Tocqueville, our place of departure for considering America is the township as it arises from the familial, religious, and other small groups that gave form to its social state. So far, so good? All right. So now we have man naturally existing in society. But, as Tocqueville notes, if he's in society, there has to be some authority. Because if there's no authority in society, we devolve into anarchy. Now, this is not some super abstract principle. This is just the way things work. If there's not authority, things fall apart. When I forget to mow my lawn, my garden testifies to this. When my wife is gone for a week, the dishes testify to this, right? If there's not some kind of exercising creative authority going on, things fall apart. It works that way in society. It works that way anywhere else we want to look. So the role of government, then, is to navigate between, on the one hand, falling into anarchy and falling apart, and then overcorrecting and establishing a tyranny. The image that Tocqueville would like to use is something from Homer. Right? Homer's Odyssey, written well before we have any kind of serious democracy. Odysseus is trying to go home. He wants to see his wife, his son. He wants to sit and tell the stories of his culture, remember the history, maybe meet with some drinking buddies, right? He's on his way to these network of small intermediary relationships. And so he's navigating his ship, and on the one side of his ship is a whirlpool, our anarchy. And on the other side of his ship is a six-headed monster that we could call tyranny. And so the goal of government is to navigate this ship of state between tyranny and anarchy, and lead us to those social structures that make life worth living. Okay? Government is to provide a juridical framework that respects the freedom of the individual, the family, and those secondary cultural and political institutions. This happens when every member of society is, I'm going to quote the compendium of the Catholic Church's social doctrine, which seems to go really well along with Tocqueville. This happens when every member of society is permitted to fulfill his personal vocation, to seek the truth, and profess his religious, cultural, and political ideas, to express his opinions, to choose his state of life and, as far as possible, his line of work, to pursue initiatives of an economic, social, or political nature. Now, the problem is, when society is confronted with the threat of anarchy, we tend to overcorrect. Just like Odysseus, I got to choose between the whirlpool and the six-headed monster. I'm going to let a few of my men get picked off by the six-headed monster. Similarly, that's what society does. Oh, it looks a bit like anarchy. Let's swerve over here toward tyranny. We have some kind of thing that I feel is threatening the nature of my society. And so rather than resolve it on a cultural level, I want to legislate it. I want to make the solution something the government does, as opposed to doing the hard work of resolving it here in these social relationships. My neighbor has a messy lawn. I'll ask the city council to make him fix it rather than have a block meeting. Okay? But, all right. The problem is, as we make these laws that infringe into this network of relationships, society itself becomes progressively more disorganized and eventually goes into decline. So the end of tyranny is going to always be anarchy. If we resolve too quickly to the legislative solution, skipping the cultural solution, we end up in the whirlpool anyway. Doesn't matter. All right. So, that was a long bit of work to define freedom. And what we've realized is we have freedom can be said in two different ways now. Right? In one way, we can say that freedom is this arrangement of government and economy that allows individuals, their families, and the cultural society they act within to function as subjects of a certain sovereignty. a certain freedom appropriate to their level. So negatively, we say government hands off. Okay? But this other sense of freedom is this idea of the place where the individual works within the spheres of the family, religion, and social culture, ordered to these transcendent goods of the true, the just, and the beautiful. And there, if that's working, I'll be able to ensure a free government. But if I have the free government and these social networks aren't working, in the end, I'm going to fall into either tyranny or anarchy. Okay? As Stoeckel notes, the laws of America help preserve its liberty, but it is the customs, the habits of thought and heart that characterize its action at the familial, religious, and township level that are the more important. Now, there's two kinds of tyranny that are going to be specific to what threaten Americans. On the one hand, we end up with the tyranny of the majority, right? 51% of us vote, but you 49% don't get to go outside today, right? Or whatever the solution is we make. The majority tyrannizes, takes away the freedom from the minority. The other tyranny that we're worried about is the soft tyranny, where we get a bunch of individualized Americans that are pursuing their own selfish interests, not concerned with these larger social networks, and then the state is able to sort of run everything for them. Both kinds of tyranny, according to Tocqueville, are prevented by nurturing these intermediate associations we've been talking about. Strong families, strong chess clubs, strong trade unions, whatever we want. Those things are going to be our sure line against either form of tyranny. It's clear that we can see how they might temper the tyranny of the majority. Right? If the majority votes to run over my house and I'm standing there in front of the steamrollers, they can maybe look away and run over me. But if I got five of my friends to stand in front of the steamrollers, it's a little bit tough to run over me. Right? I get a little bit more authority the more I go into associations with other groups. Secondly, if we're in associations, it's just a lot tougher to be a jerk to someone else. Right? If I'm like, I don't like you, but you're in my chess club and I really need you to help me at the next tournament, or, you know, you're a great forward for my hockey team, so I'm not going to kick you out of town after all. That happens. It's not the most enlightened basis for political decision-making, but it's the beginning of social decision-making that prevents the tyranny of the majority. Right? But secondly, the soft tyranny, where we're just obsessed, right, with our own concerns, getting involved in our church groups, getting involved in jury duty, going to city council meetings, these sorts of things necessarily draw me out of my own selfish focus. I have to listen to a lot of different opinions. I am, as Tocqueville says, given a free education where my sentiments are enlarged, my ideas are expanded, and all of a sudden a new world opens up to me. So both of these ways, so both forms of tyranny are going to be combated by us joining these groups and nurturing these groups. Great! Fantastic! Except we don't do that. All right? Here's the bad news. Here's what I've been building up to. All this great, beautiful image is that it's dying. It's going away. It doesn't exist in America anymore. In the year 2000, Robert Putnam wrote a book called Bowling Alone. And in that book, he noted, there are more Americans bowling than ever before. And there are fewer bowling clubs than ever before. He opens the first chapter talking about going to this group of old people that still play bridge together every week. But the bridge club has been dissolved for the last 5 years because they couldn't get people to come to bridge club meetings. Right? So what we have is what Robert Putnam says, declining social capital. Over the 25 years between 1975 and the year 2000, associations tank. Now, that's not simply the case. We have far more volunteer organizations than we ever have before. But no one goes to meetings. Being a member of an organization means you send in your annual check, you get your membership card, and you get the catalog. It doesn't mean you go to any kind of a club meeting. Let's give some statistics. Between 1975 and the year 2000, there was a 58% drop in club meetings. attendance at club meetings. There was a 35% drop in having friends over to your house. And there was a 43% drop in family dinners. Not one of those intermediate social levels that are the atmosphere, the framework for liberty, stuck around. They're all under attack. And this has a necessary effect on our civil engagement. In 2011, Dr. Christian Smith, a sociologist from Notre Dame, published a study of what he called emerging adulthood. That is, this newly forming demographic of young people between the ages of 18 and 30 in America. On the basis of a large national survey and lots of in-depth interviews taken from a cross-section of society, Dr. Smith and his colleagues describe what they see as defining and disturbing features of this group. And here's the one we're most concerned with. 4% of young adults between the ages of 18 and 30 are what we would call genuinely political. 4% are actively involved in political organization work, in volunteer work, in any kind of major societal involvement. Now, 31% of this demographic say they're political. But what 27% mean by that is they sometimes watch the news and will occasionally talk about the news with friends around the water cooler. Right? 27% of this population are completely apathetic. They don't care. 13% are completely uninformed. They have no idea what's going on. 19% just don't trust anything that any of the politicians do. And 10% feel so disempowered they don't think it's worth getting involved. So 69% are completely off. They're not involved in any way, shape, or form in political life. 27% are passively involved, and we only have 4 that are meaningfully involved. Now, Dr. Smith suggests that the causes of this disengagement are radical individualism, an obsession with consumerism as opposed to the common good, a lack of sense of moral connection to the community, and the fact that we've replaced a lot of what was used as social involvement, political time, with Facebook and Twitter. But here we have a problem. If this involvement in these small organizations is what preserves liberty, is what keeps us from falling into either tyranny or anarchy, we're in bad shape. So what do we do? Tocqueville gives us clear idea. Number one, we need to get involved in secondary, intermediate social bodies. Now, that could be political groups, right? Now, that could be, you know, I'm a member of the Tea Party, or I'm a member of Occupy Wall Street, or whatever the case may be. Or that could be, I'm a member of Chess Club, or I'm a member of the book club at the library, or I occasionally throw block parties, and I know all the names of my neighbors. Right? Tocqueville, of course, doesn't talk about this, but I'm going to throw this one out as tempering the use of our technology. If we have something that's replacing our social interaction, we should take that out a little bit so we have some more room for interaction. Maybe a little bit less friending on Facebook and more friending with a neighbor. Okay? Next, we need to empower local government, not by massive legislative reforms, but just by going to the city council meeting. Right? If a lot of us were involved in our local government, if a lot of us were involved in those local issues, those would become more important. People would get concerned. If our news came not exclusively from Fox News, but we occasionally read the community section of the paper, we would get tied in to concrete things that actually initiate action. I can stew a lot about what's going on in Syria, but I have to do something about the overrun dog pound. It's not as exciting, but it actually is what expands my sentiments, enlarges my social awareness. All right. I want to end here with a sobering prediction that Tocqueville gives of what happens when we let this network of freedom fall apart. Tocqueville says, I imagine that I see an innumerable crowd of like and equal men who revolve only on themselves, procuring the small and vulgar pleasures with which to fill their souls. Each of them withdraws apart and is like a stranger to the destiny of all others. His fellow citizens dwell beside him, but he does not see them. He touches them, but does not feel them. Above these, an immense power is elevated, which alone takes charge of assuring their enjoyments and watching their fate. So it is that every day it renders the employment of free will less useful and more rare. It confines the action of the will in a smaller space, and little by little steals the very use of it from its citizens. Thus the sovereign extends its arm over society as a whole. It covers its surface always for the good of its citizens. Nevertheless, though, it covers its surface with a network of small, complicated, painstaking, uniform rules. It does not break wills, but softens them, bends them, directs them. It does not tyrannize, it hinders, compromises, innervates, and finally reduces the nation to being nothing more than a herd of timid, industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd, and the Constitution remains unchanged. 130 years ago, President Abraham Lincoln asked whether a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal could long endure. President Lincoln's question is no less a question for this present generation of Americans. Democracy, or at least a free democracy, cannot be sustained without a shared commitment to certain truths about the human person and human community. The basic question before a democratic society is, how ought we to live together? And so the question comes to us. Granted the chance to cultivate the character of our nation, what is it that we will choose to grow? Thank you.